today was a very special day in my house. I waited until after the wife went to bed this morning after she got home from work. Fixed me a little bit of lunch around noontime. I closed all the blinds in the house. Didn't want anybody peeking around or nothing. And I got out my $300 bottle of Herradura Selección Suprema. I turned the ringers off all the phones. And I sat quietly in my chair, undisturbed, for about 40 minutes, sucking on this 2-ounce pour of Herradura. And it was an exquisite experience. So that's all I got to say about that. Hey, welcome to the Mead House. let's not talk tequila. Let's talk mead tonight. I'm going to forego all the regular crap. You know where we're at, themeadhouse.com. You know where to find us at the Facebook. Certainly picking up a lot of business there. The Mead House, real easy to find. Ryan Richardson in-house tonight. Aaron Martin along for the ride. Welcome back, Mississippi Chris Spencer. Jeff Schaus is in the house. My name is J.D. Webb. And Ryan, I think you're going to be out, what, next week?
I'm going to be out. I've got a surprise announcement for everyone listening out there in Mead House land. I am traveling for work. I'm going to be part of the week in Jacksonville, Florida, and I set up a meeting or I guess interview, chit-chat, drink, whatever you want to call it, with John Harris of Harris Meadery in Jacksonville. So I am going to have a little chat with him, taste some of his meads, and report back when I am back with you all in 2 weeks.
Cool. You got to see if you can pick up some audio, take some kind of a recording device or something if you have to, and see if he'll sit interview, and then let's talk afterwards. But that sounds like a lot of fun.
Absolutely.
And the Facebook thing, Jeff is Jeff's our guy that looked after the Facebook, and he cruises around. He finds some pretty interesting stuff. What'd you find this week, Jeff?
You know, it may just be that I do a lot of floral meads, but I found a lot of people doing floral type projects on especially the Mead Makers group this week. There were two people that were working with dandelions specifically. Pedro Lima had asked a question about if there was a difference essentially in the types of dandelions he was using because his looked a lot smaller than everyone else's. Another gentleman, I'm going to butcher this first name, like Cowan Meyer, actually posted a recipe for dandelion wine. That I've seen floating around a time or two, and I've really thought long and hard about trying to make a dandelion mead because that sounds really delicious. Then I saw a really cool experiment that a gentleman named Ryan James Clowder did using chrysanthemums. He actually set this up with essentially like four different batches. Two of the batches used D47. Two of the batches used Pasteur Blanc yeast. And all of them were using chrysanthemums. Now, in two of these trials, he left the leaves in primary to ferment, and in two, he just kind of steeped a tea with them and left it out. And in the case where the ones were left in primary, he said that the leaves gave it kind of a hoppy quality, that kind of a lingering bitterness, whereas without, they actually end up being very floral. It had a kind of that perception of sweetness that we associate with some of the floral kind of ingredients or hops that you add to meads. I thought that was a really cool experiment. I've heard of chrysanthemum. I've not gotten the chance to see, you know, even if you can buy food grade chrysanthemum like on Amazon or somewhere to work with that. So
that I've is. Seen a lot, but I've seen a lot of them in florist shops.
Right, and I've heard that I think. in Korea, they, Korean is a has a wine that's kind of a traditional product there. That's it's very beloved, and I think that's what kind of cued me into chrysanthemums in the first place. But yeah, no, that was a really cool experiment to hear about, and was glad to see that people are working with, you know, adding flowers into mead. Then I saw another another question from a gentleman named Daryl Beck. Basically, he was asking some questions about getting started with Bochets, and it started a really great line of you know, tips and tricks. And we've talked about Bochets a number of times on the show. There was Matt Whitey, and I've mentioned him more than once here too, had a really helpful answer as far as kind of dialing in the character of your the toastedness or the caramelization of your honey based on based on color. And he added some of his own photos of his process where, you know, you've got all the way to the dark black, there's the orange, and the kind of the intermediaries in that. There was also, that reminds me a little while back, a discussion that Matt was placing on Facebook, and one of our listeners who's been on the show before, Patty Mackey, actually mentioned that she's doing an experiment with Bochets.
Yeah, I saw that, yeah.
And so I dropped her a line a little while back, and she's interested in joining us. Well, she's got some more results, but, you know, we're kind of, she's interested in testing the idea that the heat would create unfermentable sugars and leave more of a residual sugar or residual sweetness in the mead, which, you know, I think makes sense on a level of, you know, just pure science and like protein folding in response to heat, things like that. But, you know, I don't have any empirical evidence, and it sounds like she's going to get some. So good for her, and looking forward to hearing on that as soon as she's got some results.
Yeah.
And then with the same line of conversation on Daryl Beck, another one of our longtime listeners, Scott Monroe, threw out a great tip that I thought was worth mentioning on the whole crockpot thing. He says he's using crockpot liners to do the caramelization. That way, when it cools, you could just cut off the end of the one of the corners of the liner and use that kind of like a piping bag to get the honey into your must. Which,
well, there you go.
Yeah, that's like a no-mess, really great tip. So wanted to throw him a shout-out, too, on that one, because that's really cool.
Yeah. You know, and I don't know. I've seen those things at the store, and I don't know. I wonder what they would be like to store the honey in if you're not going to use it right away. At least you've got something that, I mean, you know, you can just slip the bottom of the bag open and you know, dump it into your carbide. I mean, I don't know how much easier that would be, you know, if you wanted to store it or not. But interesting. That's a hell of an idea.
That, you know, and that's a good point, too. I mean, the only concern I would have is keeping bugs or other, you know, pests out of it.
Right.
Keep it airtight, essentially. Because, you know, we know that honey will store indefinitely. And if you've caramelized it, you know, that there's even less water in there, so it should store even better.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, and I, you know, this is one of those things, you know, going back to the 51% thing and the braggot. I've always heard that not all the sugar in caramelized honey is fermentable, but I've never been able to get anybody to say, well, exactly how much, you know? So that you can kind of build that into your recipe. You know, if you had an idea of how much fermentable sugar you're actually going to get, it might help with your gravity readings and whatnot. You know, when you're putting a recipe together. So I'd be very interested in what Patty finds out about that.
You know, I had a Facebook post, I don't know, year and a half ago, maybe, where I was caramelizing the honey on the stove, and every 15 minutes, I took the spoon out and I showed the color change, you know, how it progressively got darker and darker. And my guess is, it's the variable is going to be the length of time that it's being cooked. and converting some of those sugars to the unfermentable state. That's a simple guess on my part, but I'm thinking that you know, if you do a 15 minute boil is going to be a lot different than a 75 minute boil or various times in the crock pot that are going to determine and change that unfermentable sugar content.
You're onto something there. Sorry to cut you off there, JD. I was also going to say the extremes of temperature might have something to do with that too. You know, cooking at a boil as opposed to, you know, on high or even on low in a crock pot may have a different impact on the way those sugars change or the proteins in the sugars degrade as a response to that heat too.
Would what do you call them damn things? It's not a hydrometer. Is that a thing that people use usually in the wine?
A refractometer?
Yeah, would that be the proper tool to use to? That's not going to work either because that's going to measure all the sugar. What we need to find out is what is fermentable and what is not. So I guess, there's a hell of an experiment being set up already. So you'd have to set up, I don't know, maybe four or five, let's say four. You do it on a quarter hour. So you pull the first 15 out, dump that into a gallon thing, start your mead, pull the one at 30 minutes and then the one at 45 minutes and the one at the hour, and, you know, record the temperature of the honey. You know, at least if you can get some idea of the temperature you're cooking at, and you know, do it that way, and, you know, put equal amounts of honey. You know, I mean, it sounds like a mess being being made in the kitchen at this point. But I mean, that to me would be the, you know, probably a more identifiable type experiment to determine how much sugar. And of course, the measurement would be what's left after fermentation using the same yeast, the same, you know, nutrient protocol, and what have you. I mean, rudimentary at best, I'm sure, because, you know, we're not sitting in a lab, but,
sure.
I mean, what the heck? You know, you get a ballpark, you know.
Right. And, you know, I would also suggest, you know, in that kind of a protocol, we'd probably want to do something session strength so that it ferments absolutely bone dry. And the only thing left over is those unfermentable sugars. That seems like a pretty good protocol. There's probably, you know, a couple points of variance that are opening up there just because every batch is going to be a little bit different. But, you know, I think you could get some pretty solid results, or at least a ballpark there, doing it that way.
Yeah. Interesting. Cool stuff, Jeff. Had anything else?
That was it.
You know, I was going to let you finish, but I wanted to give you my opinion on dandelion wine and dandelion mead. It's one of those things that is a great idea in theory until you realize that you're going to spend about, you know, 97 hours of your day, you know, picking dandelions, picking it clean so you don't get any of the green or the white, you know, rinsing them off. And then, you know, and after all that, you're going to have enough for a 1 gallon batch that's
right.
Going to need to age for about 3 years before supposedly it hits its peak potential. I did do an experiment once. You know, from what I've heard, dandelion wine is very good after a handful of years of aging. I did do an experiment once where I and the process wasn't clean, so it wasn't a great test. But I said, why don't we just buy dandelion herbal tea and use dandelion herbal tea instead of using dandelion flowers and see if we can get a little bit of the way there that way. Because you start picking dandelions, you're going to realize there's a whole day's job right there for a 1 gallon batch in 3 years.
Well, yeah, and how do you sanitize dandelion flowers? I mean, you know.
Sulfite.
You know,
well, supposedly, what? There's a few different things, but yeah.
Yeah, what flavor of dog was that was in the yard last week? Oh, yeah.
Nope. I can see where that's going. Up another line of inquiry I've seen, though, because there's actually this soda in Britain that's really popular. It's a traditional soda that started out as kind of an alternative to beer. It's dandelion and burdock root. They used to use these as flavorants in an alcoholic beverage, and then as soda became more popular, it kind of got its own popularity there as a non-alcoholic beverage. I've never actually tracked down one of these British sodas that are so popular over there, supposedly. But it's an interesting idea because, you know, it may be a British flavor, but dandelion and burdock, as far as I am aware, grow wild over here for the most part, too.
Oh. Isn't dandelion wine something of the South, Chris?
I think it's more East Coast, over in the Carolinas and up into New Jersey. I've never heard of it around here. I don't know anyone who makes it.
Yeah.
But we got plenty of dandelions, so it would be easy enough.
Yeah. All right. Well, hey, good stuff on the Facebook. We'll have to keep an eye on that. And, Jeff, if you would, stay up with Patty Mackey and stay in contact with her. And let's see if we can't get her on the show here in the future when she gets some more results off that experiment that she's doing. In the meantime,
JD,
yeah,
I don't know what you've got laid out as far as the format for this show, but while we're on the subject of answering questions and addressing listeners, didn't we get an email from someone who wanted to know about the Lalazine?
Yep, and that's actually coming up next.
Okay, well I'll let you take care of the lead into that.
That's on the list. And while we're at it, what are we drinking? Let's just start off with Mississippi, since he's been AWOL for the last couple, month or two, or no? How long has it been? A couple of weeks?
Oh God, I don't even know what day it is. I just got a good cold glass of iced tea.
Sweet tea?
Of course.
Is there any other kind?
The only other way to drink it is hot and unsweetened. And
yeah. They picked me out of a crowd when my first trip in North Carolina and sitting in a restaurant. Boy, the old gal was waiting on our table. She just knew I wasn't from around there and asked me if I wanted sweet tea or not. My two friends sitting at the tables just broke out laughing. Because I guess the people, you live back there, they don't even ask you. They just bring you sweet tea, period. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, Aaron, what you pour in your glass tonight, bud?
So, I am drinking a beer. This is from a local brewery here in the area, the Carolina Barn House, located in Anderson, South Carolina. And this is a beer they call their Petite Creek. This is a brewery that's really known for their sours. And this is a pretty mild sour, not overly sour. It's their base sour golden ale that they age in Syrah barrels. Then after that, they blend in some Montmorency cherries. And really, this is just delightful. It's light-bodied, it's tart, crisp, has a really nice cherry flavor. And I've just really been enjoying some of the beers I've been sampling from this brewery here.
Cool. Sounds good. Jeff, would you pour in your glass tonight, bud? Take your mic off of mute there, Jeff, and chime on in, bud.
There we go. phone was not cooperating with me getting that that mute off. So tonight I've got my Scotch Ale kit that I made. It was from Adventures in Homebrewing. I picked this one up because my wife really likes Scotch Ale. It's one of the first beers that she tried that she really enjoyed was a Belhaven, and I think we've talked about that before. Just a really, really smooth Scotch Ale. Another one of her favorites is a 90 Schilling. I forget which company makes that. But this is a kind of a clone of that one. And I think for whatever reason, mine didn't come out quite the way it was supposed to. It has a little bit more roasty character to it than was intended, I think. And so unfortunately, you know, I made this for my wife. She doesn't quite like it, but I'm really digging it. So
yeah, cool.
I am happily enjoying this in her stead.
Cool. And, you know, I had her on Facebook the other night, and we got a plan. We're going to wait until you go to bed. You know, we're going to sit up late at night and compare tequilas. I understand she's quite the tequila lover.
She can be, yeah.
Cool. Hey, Ryan, what did you pour in your glass tonight?
You know, I had to finish off the last beer that I got down in Iowa. They're non-pasteurized, you know, unfiltered, bottle carbonated beers. And, you know, in my experience, those can degrade rather quickly. And so I'm finishing it off tonight. It's another IPA. It's excellent. It's very good. And then the next time we talk, I will be, back to mead. I've got, my honey Kolsch, or actually better to be said, it would be a Kolsch Bregget, will be ready. And I'll be giving you guys notes on that one the next time we chat.
Cool. Sounds good. Well,
I'll be having a couple from me to give a taste test to also by the next, maybe not next show, but by the next one for sure.
Cool. I, on a graph tonight, Chris, my, how this thing changes. this is unbelievable. I'm telling you, this thing has really smoothed out. And you know, I, at first, you know, I'm thinking, you know, even after the first, say, 4 months, you know, I had a bottle of it a couple months ago, and I'm thinking, nah, just, you know, I just really need some work somewhere. I just got to nail it down. But you know what? I think I would probably do this recipe again, and just let it sit in the carboy, let it age out, and just don't mess with it. And I think I would put this in a keg and put it on one of my taps. This stuff is unbelievable.
Well, the grass is going to be one that's going out along with a couple of meads to all of you. And to be fair, I have not tasted it since the last time it came up. And I think that was maybe February.
Yeah.
It's been a long time. I can't remember. It's been a long time. And I put it back and forgot about it, and I'm going to send out a bottle, so I'm not going to taste mine again until everyone on the show is tasting it. And just I'll try to lead you through how it changed, but you already tasted JD, so you know what it tastes like when it's younger.
Yeah.
So we'll see. It's going to be a surprise to me, too.
Yeah, this is, you know, it's absolutely in the cider category. I mean, I wouldn't put it anywhere else, even with all the beer ingredients that goes into this thing. It's definitely a cider. I mean, the apple is like right there, right up front. Very malty. Just the tartness. I was worried about the tartness because early on it this thing goes from wicked, whacked out, stinking, smelly gym socks to something worse, and it comes back and it's incredibly tart, and then it just starts smoothing out, and it's to a point now where it's damn near perfect. I've had bottled ciders that have been just as tart. The one I made here that I enjoy so much that I make here with my Nottingham yeast, same thing. It's got a certain level of tartness in there to, you know, remind you of that tart apple. This stuff is great. Very, like I said, very malty, malt forward. This stuff is killer, guys. I'm telling you. And Chris, I don't know that I'd even mess with the recipe.
Yeah, well, mine's approaching, if not already, 7 months. It's right at the 7 month mark. So if it's going to come into its own, it should be starting. It should be well in on its way now. So
yeah,
a couple more weeks, I'll get you guys a bottle and we'll all compare it and see.
And
maybe everybody can remember what yours tasted like when it was younger, so we can compare it to that, because yours was at the stage that mine was at. It tasted exactly the same recipe. Right. So
yeah. That being said, I was cleaning out some folders on my computer and I ran across this, and I can't for the life. I should have printed the damn thing out. Oh gosh, something about winemaking. Anyway, it's got some. It was obviously written a number of years ago, like a long time ago. It's got this recipe in it for something called Andover Ale. I'm going to read the ingredients to you. It's 1 pound of malt extract, 1 ounce of hops, 1 gallon of water, brewer's or dried yeast, 1 level teaspoon of liquid gravy browning. you have any idea what that is?
Crap.
Liquid.
Crap.
Okay. Liquid gravy browning. Now, I think, because in parentheses next to it, it has caramel. Now, I think what this is a coloring, some form of color. I don't think it's like, you know, mashed potato and gravy. I think
it's a coloring. You're right. It's a coloring, and it's got a little bit of seasoning in it, but not much. Mostly just a little salt. And no respectable Southerner would ever make gravy for their biscuits with that stuff.
Right.
Ever.
Ever. So, anyway, I ran across it. I thought it was funny. I thought I'd read this recipe off liquid gravy. So, anyway, Chris, we did. We got an email from an avid listener, Christian. He had a lot of questions. Well, not a lot of questions. He had a question about using pectic enzymes. Wanted to know, because he had listened to a show that Chris was talking about using a couple of different pectic enzymes, one called Lalozyme C-Max, the other one Lalozyme EX. And wanted to basically know which one he should be using, if there was a difference between the two. So I know Chris has got quite a bit of experience with this. So, Chris, talked about this on the show before, but let's go through again. Maybe we can get in a little more detail for him and help him out. So take it away.
Okay. Well, short answer, use both. There's one called C-Max, and there's one called EX, the Lalozyme EX. I know that they're both available from More Beer. I think that's where I got them. And it takes a very small amount. And so we can look at C-Max, EX, and then regular pectic enzyme. These are things that you accomplish several things with. You extract flavor from fruit, you extract color, and you help with clearing after the fact. So when I read the descriptions of the C-Max and the EX, it almost come across to me as though they would do the same thing, but then again, there was something different about them. It was like maybe one of them was geared more toward color extraction and one was more flavor and aroma extraction. So I approached it the same way that I approach pectic enzyme. You're really not going to hurt a mead or a wine or anything by putting too much in or whatever. So I ordered both. They're cheap enough. And I put both in. Now, the way that I use it is when I'm using whole fruit, be it fresh or frozen, I put the fruit in a bucket with an airlock on it. I put a little bit of water, just enough to dissolve my sulfite tablets and the enzyme. And then I mash the fruit up, put the enzyme along with the sulfite into the bucket, put a lid on it with an airlock, and I let it sit for usually about 4 days. It's crucial that you put the sulfites in because you don't want spontaneous fermentation. It's also crucial to have an airlock just in case fermentation does kick up. You don't want an exploding bucket. So sulfite, and put this C-Max, I put a combination. I put the recommended dosage of each in the fruit. And after about 4 days, you have extracted most of the color and flavor that you're going to get from that fruit. And 4 days is long enough because if you go ahead and put everything into your must, the enzyme is going to continue to act and be active even during the fermentation. So it's a good way to get the most flavor and color from your fruit. It also helps later on with clearing, like I said. When I use C-Max and EX together, I do not use pectic enzyme because it already has it in it, and quite frankly, it's just overkill. It won't hurt a thing if you want to go ahead and put it in. The reason I started doing that is because when I was working on the Heart Murmur project, I was trying to get everything I could get from the fruit because I wanted it to just be over the top. And I found out that things cleared up a lot faster when I used it. And up to that point, I had only been using pectic enzyme. And I found out that one of the key components that I was missing was amylase. Now, you can buy amylase enzyme separately by itself, but there's a lot of fruit that you get hold of that has quite significant amounts of amylopectin, and just regular pectic enzyme won't really get it out, and that can affect clearing. It's not so much flavor, but it is a clearing problem with some people. So when you use the EX and the C-Max together, you can eliminate the amylase, you can eliminate the pectic enzyme, just use those two, and you can rest assured you're going to get everything that the fruit has to offer. Now, Lalozyme does make a third enzyme, and I can't remember the exact name of it, but I think it was Blanc or something Blanc.
Yeah, that's one I can speak to.
Yeah, now that one I assume I've always figured it was for lighter colored fruits like peaches, bananas, pears, and things like that. I don't know that for a fact, but given my experience, I would probably, if I was using a lighter colored fruit, I'd probably just throw all three in.
Sure.
Go ahead and tell what you know about it.
So I was doing a freezer clean out Melomel, and I got a chest freezer in the basement, and I had it filled up with it's half of it's all kinds of meat, you know, lamb and beef and pork and everything else and fish. And then the other, and I had just frozen fruit bags on the other side of it, fruit scraps mostly. Peaches, plums, nectarines, strawberries, pineapple, mango, apples, pears, bananas, kiwis, anything you can imagine. And I had, I don't know, 30 pounds, something like that. And I wanted to do a freezer clean out melon though. And I got two or three 5-gallon paint strainer bags. And I loaded them up with as much fruit as I could fit in them. And I dropped them in a 6.5-gallon big mouth bubbler. So it basically, just, if you know, picture a glass, clear glass bucket, essentially. And I sent JD a picture. And I couldn't even get all the fruit in there out of my freezer, but I got most of it. It was fruit, frozen fruit from the bottom to the top. And then I put, I had water in there. And I had gone to the brew shop that day, and JD happened to call me while I was in the brew shop, and we got to talking. I asked the guy at the brew shop, I said, do you have any Lalizyme? And the guy goes, all we got is Cuvée Blanc. It's a macerating enzyme for white grapes. That's all I got. But I'm clearancing it out at 49 cents a gram or something, you know, like that. I think usually it goes for, you know, what, $3 or $4 a gram or something like that. And I said, oh, okay, well, I'll take a handful of grams. And I do kind of the procedure, you know, I got the waters in there on top of the fruit, and I put the Lalizyme on there that I had mixed up and everything else. And I set it, and I'm going to let it sit for 48 hours or so and just wait for this to just all dissolve. Nothing happens. I think I had 2 or 3 grams in there. Nothing happened. Mm-hmm. And I said, okay, well, let's see. So I put in some regular pectic enzyme and then I put in my yeast, and I think it was 1116. I don't have my notebook in front of me. I think it was 1116 though. And 24 hours later, it looks like, I sent JD another picture. It looks like 3 paint strainer bags that are completely empty just floating on the top of this bucket. I don't know if the Cuvée Blanc Lalizyme loosened it up, you know, the way that I loosen up a pickle jar before my wife opens it. That's a joke, guys. it didn't turn it into this, you know, sloppy juice before I put in the regular pectic enzyme and a little bit of yeast. But like I said, within 48 hours, it was nothing but bubbling away. So I guess what I'm saying is, unless you need to macerate white grapes, I don't recommend the Cuvée Blanc.
Well, I can tell you with the C-Max and the EX sitting on the fruit for 4 days, and I do go by, you know, a couple times a day and give it a little swirl or something. But after 4 days, anything like cherries, raspberries, or any kind of berry like that, you could put the stuff in a blender and run it for 4 days, and it wouldn't be any more liquid than it is after 4 days on that stuff. So, I mean, it definitely breaks it down, and then it continues to work during fermentation. So,
it also helps to, every day, go in and stir it up a little bit, get a potato masher, or something, and, 2x4 mm-hmm. like Mississippi uses, and, you know, mash it down and stir it up and, you know, keep working it over that course of that 4 days, too.
But before we leave this, let me say, the major benefit, aside from everything I've already mentioned, if you put your fruit in a strainer bag and you put it through this process, you can lift that strainer bag out. You won't have a lot in it, but you will have some. Let it drain and use the liquid in your must to mix it up, and you will get almost an exact specific gravity that's accurate, because all the fruit cells have already ruptured, and they've released not only their sugars, but they've released their water also. This is a major problem. I think I've mentioned this before, but it's a problem I've always had. I mix up a honey and water must, and I put fruit in. I get a gravity, and then I put the fruit in, and as soon as the fruit starts to get broken down, the gravity changes drastically, not from fermentation, but from the fruit releasing all this water.
Yeah.
And it's hard to know exactly what your true starting gravity was that way. If you do this, you can put the liquid portion of the juice in there, get an accurate starting gravity, and then you can lower your strainer bag with the pulp in there into primary, and you know you're much more accurate. So that's the big advantage for me.
Yeah. Again, that's Lalozyme C-Max, typically used for white grapes or white fruit, the EX, or the reds. I'm with Chris. I don't see any reason why, just throw them both in there. It's not going to hurt it a bit, and you'll be assured of getting a good maceration on your fruit. The thing about using fruit too, I want to really emphasize this, because I've tried melomel after melomel with some of the fruits that I get at the store, and I've harped on it before on the air or on the show. You got to get the ripest fruit you can find. And frankly, some of this garbage that they sell in the store that you got to sit out on the table for a week, that just doesn't cut it. So if you got a You Pick Me orchard or something close, or someplace, farmers markets, where you might be able to get your hands on some really ripe stuff, do that, because you'll produce a much better mead that way.
If I'm going to a supermarket, given the choice between the fresh fruit that they have at the supermarket or the fruit from the frozen section, I'm going with the frozen section.
Yeah.
Because that fruit is much riper when they freeze it than the stuff that's sitting out on the shelf.
Yeah, good point. So, Christian, I hope that helps. We certainly appreciate you sending in the email. And thanks again for being an avid listener of the Mead House. I talked about, Chris doesn't know this thing, and I'm not going to run through the recipe again, but last week I talked about this recipe that I'm going to use, probably going to put it together next week using some leftover stuff that I have. And we talked a little bit about the hops. That's one thing that I did have to buy for it was hops, and I chose to buy Chinook. And so I thought, I don't know a whole lot about these hops. I have no idea which particular variety hop does what. And the little bit that I know that there are some varieties out there that are, good for really nothing more than just aroma, some for flavor, and then there's a whole other set that are good for, that's your bittering hops. They really don't provide much in flavor or aroma at all. That gives you all your bittering needs. So I thought, between Jeff and Ryan, and I know Aaron has had some experience with these hops, I thought maybe we could have a brief discussion about all these different varieties. If you're looking for nothing more, I'm going to shoot this over to Jeff to start. if you're looking for nothing more than a lightly hopped, I'm not talking something like an IPA or, you know, something that's completely whacked out like my wife's favorite beer, which is that Arrogant Bastard Ale by Stone. It's just something lightly hopped and a nice aroma in the end. What are you looking for at that point?
You know, for my money, if I'm going to make a lightly hopped mead with a nice aroma, I'm going to do one of the classical noble hops. The reason they call these noble hops is that they are kind of the staples of the Czech and the German lager and brewing in general communities. We're talking saws from the Czech Republic or Tettnangs, Hallertaus. There's one other in this category. It's four hops. They've been grown, and the names that they use for them are they're from the region of the country that they're grown in, essentially. So they're named after that region. These are the ones that are known for being low in terms of bitterness. They have a great floral character to them, and there's a lot of aroma. There's a lot of pungency to the aroma. There's a lot of that floral flavor to them, but it's very light and airy. I tried one of my first hop meads I made was just some leftover saws that I had sitting around from a Czech lager that I'd made before, and it turned out fantastic. It was actually one of the most enjoyable meads that I'd made to that point, just because of the, you know, that same perceived sweetness that we keep harping on with these hop meads. I used just under like half an ounce of saws pellets in a gallon, and it came out fantastic. As far as hops go, like you said, there are a few different classifications of hops. You can think of these in terms of a couple different groups. There's the aroma and flavor. The aroma and flavor hops. There's bittering hops. And then there's kind of a dual purpose hop that is growing in popularity. There's a number of those that are coming in the market. That Saison recipe that I posted last summer uses Mosaic, which is a really popular one. It has a great a great aroma and flavor character to it, but it also has a lot of bittering potential too. So those are becoming more and more popular. You can kind of classify the aroma and flavor hops into a few different categories too. I mean, if you harken back to the experiment that Aaron did, you have a few different varieties of them available. There's the kind of earthy hops that are more associated generally with like English style ales. There's the fruitier hops that are related to, you get kind of a citrus flavor to them, the grapefruit, the lemon, things like that. There are floral hops like the saws, not the saws, the saws being one of them, the noble hops that I was talking about before. And of course, there are some other varieties that are outside of that little noble family as well. But you can generally find them, think of them in those three categories. I'm not sure exactly where the piney character falls in that, but there are definitely some hops that have a really pleasant kind of a pine character that is, it's a little bit on that citrusy fruity side, a little bit on the earthy side. So they kind of might fall somewhere between the two. But I think that would be how I would divide kind of hops as far as just categorization.
What, go ahead, Ryan. You got something to add there.
I was going to say, I think spalt is the other noble hop you were thinking of.
That could be. Spalt sounds familiar.
And Cascade, if I'm not mistaken, is also one of those that can be a little bit fruity and a little bit piney. That's all great info that Jeff said. I actually was going to take this question from a slightly different angle. And the angle that I was going to give was my process in how I use hops when I make beers and braggots. And if you follow recipes and you read recipes and follow recipes for beers and you know base your brackets off of those, you'll see various additions along the way. You know, a 60-minute boil or a 75-minute boil and maybe a 45 and a 30 and a 15 and a 5 and a flame out and a lot of those things. And there's definitely something to that. But what I always try to do is I always try to boil things down into the easiest method of getting the greatest return. You know, I don't want to say minimal effort, but let's say minimal chance for ruining your batch for the maximum
output. Don't do a decoction.
Don't do a decoction. That's rule one.
Yeah.
And I talked about rule two, or not rule. These aren't rules. These are suggestions. In that, if you're doing a fairly standard strength beer, you don't need to do a secondary. You know, you go right from your primary, and you let go all the way, and then after your primary, you go into your bottling bucket. You know, there's no reason to do a secondary. There are several tests out there, even by the American Homebrew Association, that shows no discernible difference in a 1060 or less beer original gravity that a lot of homebrewers will get out of doing a secondary fermentation or going to bottling. But you do have that risk of additional oxygen exposure, when you do that rack in the secondary. Okay, but now on to hops. You guys also might remember that I've said if you're an extract brewer, there's really no need to boil longer than say 15 minutes, because all you're doing with the hop, all you're doing with the extract, the malt extract, is sanitizing it. It's already been concentrated down to exactly the right amount. So taking that a step further, I also don't get any benefit or noticeable benefit when I try to layer on these different hop times. So saying, 60 minutes, 45 minutes, 30 minutes, 15 minutes, 5 minutes, flame out, these little additions. Frankly, if you're going for bitterness, you need to boil long enough to get the alpha acids out, or have a high enough, alpha acid to start with when it amorizes. And then on the other side, every bit of heat and the length of heat that the hop is exposed to, you're going to start to lose some of that aroma and some of that delicateness of it. So I kind of teased this last week, but what I do is I do two additions, bittering and aroma, and that's it, nothing in between. And the first one at bittering, and again, if I'm doing a 15-minute boil, I usually use U.S. Magnum, and the amount of U.S. Magnum I use a calculator, like Brewer's Friend or something like that. And I figure out, okay, well, let's reverse engineer this. If it called for a couple of different hops that were going to produce me it tells you what the IBU is going to be. So let's say you're going to do, Crystal hops or Amarillo hops or something, and you're going to boil those for a while, or Columbus hops, and you're going to boil those, and it's going to give you a 30 IBU. I'd figure out, okay, how many ounces of U.S. Magnum am I going to need at a higher alpha acid to get that at 15 minutes to get that same IBU level? And then I find the aroma, and U.S. Magnums are great because they have absolutely no aroma. They're completely neutral. All they do is provide bitterness. And then at flame out, I add my aroma hop of whatever I want to do. So if that is the Mosaic, or if that is the Calypso or the Chinook or whatever I want to really bring out in that, I add really at flame out. And so I do two. That's really it. You do two additions. You need to up the amount of hops that you're using because you're doing it at a shorter volume on the bittering side. But you can cut your brew day or your brew time way down to do that. You can, if you're using extract, you'll actually get, I find, a more desirable color, because the longer you boil it, the darker it gets. And then when you combine that with only going into a primary and then going from your primary to your bottling bucket, you've essentially created a process that is going to reduce the chances of you ruining that batch, and increasing your chances of not wasting effort to have the highest quality beverage that you can make in that, along those lines.
Well, it's also a matter of, you know, what hops do you use? I printed out this, I don't remember where I got it. It's a hop guide. It's just a listing of a whole lot of different kinds of hops. It doesn't categorize them, which is what I wish I had. And I don't know whether that even exists out there somewhere. So maybe this is a project that I can talk Ryan into doing, put a hop list together, but categorize them. As far as bitter, aroma, and flavor. And, we can put that up. I can build a page on the website and put that up. That would be helpful to a lot of people because, this whole hop thing is rather new to me. And my only experience, of course, is, with these beer kits and braggots that I've been making. There's a couple of projects that I've done that I really haven't been all that pleased with as far as the hops go and the bittering goes. And I kind of want to ramp things up in a different direction sometimes, I think. I keep going back to that braggot that Aaron had sent out, that Chinook deal. My God, that was totally amazing stuff. I want to try to get that same wow factor out of this project that I'm working on. And so I think a lot of that is going to have to do with the hop choice that I make. Not, off the top of my head, I just picked up Chinook. Aaron kept talking in my head as I'm standing there at the refrigerator door looking at all these hundreds of different kinds of hops that he had in the refrigerator. And Aaron kept talking, Chinook, Chinook, Chinook. So that's what I got. I got an ounce of the Chinook. So I don't know whether that's the right one. I have no clue. So for people who are new out there, making meads and getting into this hop thing. Now, there's also a couple of ways to approach this. Maybe we can talk Aaron into talking about this a little bit, about dry hopping. Did you dry hop the Chinook and Eclipso and that third one that you made?
I did not. No, they were all done just with boiling. I want to say it was either 20 or 30 minute boil. With the hops kind of added in three phases to try to achieve more of that, bittering flavor aroma effect. I actually don't have a lot of experience with dry hopping, but it's something that's really interesting to me. I mean, the closest thing that I've come to dry hopping is using that Randall Jr. that I have, where I had some leftover whole hops. I want to say it was Cascade, and this Randall Jr. thing, it's basically like a container that you can mix in a beverage with different additives, whether or not it's fruit or spices or in this case, whole leaf hops. And I just kind of like steeped a dry mead in those Cascade hops. It was not a hopped mead. It was just a traditional And in doing so, you really do extract a lot of hop essence. So taking that, the step further to just a full-fledged dry hopping in the secondary, to me is something that, definitely I would be interested to try. I don't know, for anyone else on the line here, do you guys have much experience with dry hopping?
Before you get to that point, Ryan, are pellets or whole leaf? Is there, or does it make a difference?
So if I can chime in here, from what I've heard, pellets are roughly about 5 times as effective by weight, just because they are more concentrated. They basically grind up the whole hops into a denser formulary, and you get that much more effectiveness out of it. As far as freshness goes, really you're not going to get a lot of difference, just because the same effect of hops. So when they harvest hops are a really weird kind of a plant. Once you take it off of the bind, it immediately starts to degrade. If you're going to use fresh hops in a beer, they basically have to be put into the beer the same day they're harvested. They degrade that quickly. Otherwise, you have to get them into either a kiln or an air dryer or something that will take all the moisture out of it so you can preserve the hops. Otherwise, that all the alpha acids, the humulin or whatever the enzymes that are those prized characters of the hops just start to go away. They start to fade out really quickly. So the pellet is kind of it's a more durable way to preserve that, because they've generally killed and dried those hop cones. They've ground them up and they've compacted them into that pellet form, so that you're essentially by weight, you're getting more effectiveness out of your ingredients there. And it also allows them to be stored as far as in a more compacted form. Generally in a freezer or a fridge is where you see them in homebrew stores for a reason. It helps preserve the alpha acid content.
And how do you figure out, if you're going to use whole hops, how do you know, based on what you're talking about there, Jeff, how do you know how much hops to use if you're going to dry hop? At that point, if you're going to use whole leaf hops, obviously from what you're saying, from what I understand, 1 ounce of pellet hops are going to be significantly different or have a different impact than 1 ounce of whole leaf hops.
Right. Right. And this is an effect of pungency. Basically, dry hopping is its own strange little animal, because you're not going to get any of the bitterness out of hops that you would typically see in a calculator for IBUs based on right. alpha acids and time of boil. Right. All you're getting is that aroma and that flavor.
Right.
And
right.
really, I kind of approach the few dry hoppings that I've done kind of the same way as I approach spices or other ingredients added in secondary. You put in an amount that you think feels right, and you just watch it and wait and dial it in and taste it frequently until you get to the level you want.
Yeah.
And it's one of those things I think you kind of have to learn by experience. If you put in too much, you may get to that point way too quickly and have to pull it very fast. If you put in too little, you may wind up having to do a second dry hopping later to get the full effect of what you were going for. Obviously, too little is easier to correct than too much.
Well, it's another, we've talked about all different kinds of meads on the show. We've talked melomels and all kinds of different things, hopping is something that I see being done more and more frequently as I, travel around the internet, reading different articles on things. Maybe this is an offshoot from the beer industry. I don't know, but Ryan, you had you wanted to say something as well.
Yeah, Now, I'm pleased, you know, listeners, correct me if what I'll say is incorrect. But from what I understand, dry hopping is a term that traditionally just meant adding hops post-fermentation or adding hops after you're done boiling, even if you're doing it during fermentation, regardless of style of hop or type of hop. Lately, there has been another trend, and you know, lately is subjective and trend is subjective, but of what's called wet hopping. And now people will say that when you add a fresh hop, as Jeff was saying, you know, right off the vine, you know, right into your barrel of beer, that's called a wet hop. Where now some people will call dry hopping when you're not using a fresh hop. And I guess sometimes it's called fresh hopping or wet hopping, and as opposed to dry hopping, now taking a little bit of a different definition, even though I think traditionally it covered all of this process, regardless of what you were using. Okay, anyway, the original question was, have you ever dry hopped? Yes. I dry hopped a mead once. It was a traditional mead, kind of a medium strength mead, and I dry hopped it for a very long time. I think, very long, like a month. And it's still to this day. I opened a bottle a few months ago. It has the aroma of feet, not in a good way. But it actually tastes remarkably good. It's got an amazing taste to it. Now if I could just age out that feet smell, I think it would be, it'd be great.
I don't know, I'm trying to get past the feet part. never mind. Chris, have you done anything with hops at all with your meads, or no?
No, the only thing I've done with hops is follow the directions.
Yeah, me too.
that's the extent of my knowledge.
Yeah.
Whatever the recipe says to do, that's what I've done.
Well, we've talked about adding all different kinds of ingredients, even tonight, dandelions to anything else you can think of. Why not hops? Like I said, hops seems to be, people talking about it, people doing these hopped meads and stuff. So I thought it was worth a while. We can just, sit around and talk about it a little bit. I think we've done that. And I'm sure this discussion can probably go on and on and on, but I want to task Ryan with that project. If you could put together a list, I don't care if you do it on a spreadsheet or however you can put it together, but what I need are three categories of hops, the bitter, the aroma, and the flavor, and list the hops in each one of those categories. I think that would be very helpful for people who check in at the website. We could put it up as a resource. It would be helpful to me for sure. If I could just go to some place, look on a list and say, ooh, I kind of like that hop. Give a brief description of what that hop contributes. I think that'd be pretty helpful. So in all your spare
JD,
time.
concerning my usage of hops, I will say that following the directions has worked out pretty good for me.
Perfectly, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah, it has.
As far as results go.
Yeah. I was going to, something that I did not put in the email, but something that I thought was worth talking about, because I sat here with this Braggot project I was working on. Remember I said I was going to do this pecan orange thing? Well, it's in the carboy. I racked it out of the fermenter the other day, but I did not add the pecans. I got a little nervous about these pecans. After putting them in the oven for 15 minutes at 350 degrees, I took them out, and I saw no noticeable oil on the surface of the, you know, after very close inspection. And I thought, nah, you know, there's something up with this, because pecans, like the walnuts, usually, you know, have quite a bit of oil in them. And I saw no noticeable coating of shiny surface oil on them at all. So I thought, I think I'm going to back off of these pecans.
You got late season pecans.
I could have. I have no idea. I got them out of the bulk bin over at wasn't Whole Foods. I don't remember the store, but
you got late season. They have very little oil in them. They start to get dry from mid season on. So
well,
if you got late season, you're not going to get any oil at all.
But then they probably would have been perfect to use. Too late now. But the other thing I have sitting on the kitchen counter, because I like to grab a couple every once in a while, a quart jar of dried apricots. And I thought, oh, I wonder if I cut a bunch of apricots, these dried apricots up, and added them to this Braggot thing that I've got going, if that would have worked. Now, again, this Braggot was a kit. It's out of a beer kit, the La Petite Orange beer kit from Northern Brewer. My typical take the LME out, replace it with the DME, you know, trick and all that kind of stuff. So I thought, you know, let's talk about dried fruit for a minute. Are there any do's and don'ts? Good or bad about using dried fruit, guys?
Let me say here, there's a couple of different things you should be watching out for if you're using dried fruit. Generally, with fruit that has its skin intact, when we're talking generally berries in this case, the major thing you need to look out for is the coating of oil that they sometimes add as a preservative. I've seen this also on dried apricots as well. Just as a heads up there, that putting oil into mead, you can, you run the risk of that becoming rancid and nastiness that way. As far as dried fruits that are essentially their skin is cut off and, they're sliced up and done that way. We're talking, you know, pineapples, apples, bananas, to name like the three, like most common that I see. Generally, as a preservative measure, those are dipped in sugar or a sugar solution that they're then dried with, kind of to act as a preservative along the skin. So adding them that way, you are adding an additional amount of just straight glucose to your mead that you may not be accounting for otherwise.
Yeah, okay.
In addition to the fruit sugar and the honey.
Yeah, I knew about the oil, but I did not know about the sugar. Very interesting fact there. Has anybody else had any experience with using, now this includes dehydrated fruit too, which is another animal all in itself, but Ryan or Aaron?
You know, to echo what Jeff just said, I was looking for dried cherries, and I looked at about 10 different packages, and I could not find any dried cherries that did not have some sort of oil on them. And so that one, you know, you got to be careful of that. I never ended up picking them up. I ended up going with frozen cherries because those, you know, I didn't have any oil on them. And like just like Chris was saying earlier, you know, a lot of frozen fruit is it's frozen at the peak of fruit, at the peak of ripeness. So it is, it's good to use. There's a book out there. I don't have the title in front of me. It's called something to the effect of speed brewing and, something like that. You talk about making beers and meads and ciders and, I think, I've only seen a couple of the recipes, extremely quickly. And I saw a mead recipe from this book and, actually a handful of them. And the authors recommend using freeze-dried fruit. And they said that using freeze-dried fruit, you know, you can speed brew, you know, really high quality, you know, Melomel, you know, at hydromel strengths, very quickly. So I don't know if the freeze drying process is anything different or if any kind of, dried fruit might work, you know, it's a common practice.
Freeze dried. I wonder if that's the same as like, isn't that the same as like dehydrated? Aren't dehydrated basically freeze dried?
Yes and no. Freeze drying is one method of dehydration, but a lot of dehydration just involves it involves moderate temperatures and some kind of either a fan or a constant source of wind that promotes evaporation along the surface of the fruit. Whereas yeah. I forget exactly how freeze drying works, but the only fruit that I know of that I've had freeze dried really easily, I think, is strawberries. And it becomes almost this kind of a, the fruit takes on almost a quality of being styrofoam.
Uh-oh. Sounds like the dog food.
So yeah.
Go ahead.
That makes a level of sense just because you, essentially, all of the liquid in a freeze-dried product is getting taken out versus dehydration. It's just being reduced significantly. So there's still, you know, if you take pineapple, for example, in a dehydrated piece of pineapple, there's still liquid in the core of the slice that's dehydrated. It's just along the surface that it's kind of created this layer of a lack of liquid to preserve it longer. Versus with the freeze drying, I think it's a more complete process. And when you introduce that into a liquid, my intuition says that that liquid would seep its way into the fruit. Because there is alcohol there, it would be even an even more complete extraction than just essentially rehydrating it. They could very well be onto something there. I mean, this is armchair speculation at its best, but it sounds right to me.
I was able to look it up. The book is called Speed Brewing Techniques and Recipes for Fast Fermenting Beers, Ciders, Meads, and More. And it's by a woman named Mary Izett, IZETT. And I'm looking at one of her recipes right now. And, you know, it's calling for freeze-dried strawberries, you know, exactly what you said, Jeff. There must be something about the way that freeze-dried fruit, like you're saying, freeze-dried fruit it doesn't turn into this thin fruit jerky, you know, I'll call it. It does maintain a little bit of structure, which right. must allow the liquid and the yeast to permeate and really break it down in a hurry.
Well, Chris, do you have any experience with using dried fruit at all or freeze-dried stuff?
No, because I couldn't find anyone, like they were saying, it's all got oil or sugar in it. I don't think the sugar content would be that big of a deal when you think about that it's just dipped in it. But the oil definitely is a problem. I will say this, though. If you're lucky enough to find dried fruit that is free of oil, it works out to about 8 pounds of fresh fruit to 1 pound of dried. That seems to work out really well. So if your recipe, yeah, if your recipe called for 8 pounds of, fresh raspberries, then you would use about 1 pound of dried. So, but I have not been lucky enough to find any. The one time that I did find something was some dried blueberries. And they did have a little sugar on them, but they had no oil, and they worked out really well. And to be honest, when you run it through the calculator, the amount of sugar that was on those blueberries, it didn't even amount to one gravity point. So,
yeah,
it didn't affect it at all.
Well, I certainly see an experiment coming along there using some kind of dehydrated, or freeze-dried fruit for sure. But I was just, I was curious because I've got this Braggot project that I'm, working on and was going to add the pecans and, this quart jar of apricots I got sitting on the kitchen counter. I was staring at them the other day and I thought, what if I chopped up a whole bunch of those and dropped into this beer thing? And I thought, I'm going to wait till Tuesday night, check in with the boys, and see what the hell they say about it. It's probably too late now to, maybe not, but I'll have to think about it, but... I'm only about 4 days in secondary with this, what I was going to call summer pecan orange Braggot. Now it's just summer Braggot, orange Braggot. I dropped a couple of little orange peels in it, just cause I like that, that hint of orange, in it. And, I'm just going to, let it go, with the honey. And it's only got, I dropped 3.5 pounds of honey. I think I ran this recipe. Well, maybe I didn't. I don't remember what the, percentage of the honey was as far as the fermentables, but, I thought 3.5 pounds was going to give me a pretty decent starting point. With that being said, when you guys make your meads, something that occurred to me the other day, I know where each one of you live, and for a couple of us, it gets rather difficult when you're talking seasons. Do you guys, let's start with Ryan first, and go around the table. Ryan, you'll pass it off on to Aaron, and Aaron to Jeff, and so forth. When you guys are making meads, do you give the season of the year any kind of attention at all as to what you're making? In other words, do you make more lighter meads in the winter, planning for summer consumption, and make more darker, more robust type meads in the summertime, if you've got that opportunity for consumption in the wintertime? Let's start off with Ryan.
No, but that's only because I don't plan that far ahead.
So it doesn't matter. Yeah, whatever comes to mind, you put in a fermenter and the hell with it, and that's it, huh?
I got a brew list of, a running list that, by this point, it goes the entire length down the door to the fermenting room. And I brew what I kind of want to drink or what I need to make for the wife or whomever. And unfortunately, unless I'm doing a beer, seasonality doesn't come into it that much. you know, it's something that I, and again, it's something I need to plan out more. And so the only reason I'm saying no is that it's because I haven't planned that far ahead.
Jeff, what about you?
So yes and no. I noticed that I tend to, I have seasonal tastes. And so I find that I do a lot more, ragged kind of a projects in the summertime, or more, lighter bodied, more, not quite session strength, but more of those, the kind of thing that you would drink on a hot summer day in the summer when I'm thinking about that kind of a beverage. And I'm tending to go either more towards deeper, fruitier flavors or more complex flavors in the wintertime when it's like a stout season, as I would say, or just, you know, that I'm interested in something with a little bit more depth and a lot more character to it. I think that's a little bit of conditioning on my part, just from being used to craft beer and drinking in that kind of a thing. But yeah, no, I kind of brew according to my taste for the season, so that puts my brews a little bit late, all things considered. But yeah, that's kind of
I drink. How about what Aaron? I'm How about Aaron?
You know, I think my tastes are similar to yours, Jeff, with especially on the beer side, where, you know, in the cooler winter months, I will be going more for darker beers, porters, stouts, barley wines, than in the summer months, you know, going for lighter bodied, more crisp, refreshing type beers. When it comes to mead, I don't, at least historically, I don't know that I've kind of developed that as much with my habits and my brewing habits. I could see, you know, now that I'm kind of diversifying some of the stuff that I've made a little bit more from, you know, initially with my mead making experience, it was more, you know, wine strength, you know, more full bodied, higher alcohol type meads. And, you know, with this recent hop thing I did, and even that was a little bit higher in alcohol, I've been kind of diversifying into some of the more session strength, you know, lower alcohol type meads. So I could see moving forward that the season may have more of an impact on what I'm brewing, what mead I'm making. But historically for me, that I don't think that's necessarily been the case, even though like Jeff mentioned, I think on the beer side, definitely the season impacts what, you know, what I'd reach for.
Chris, you brew by the season at all, or do you give it any thought at all?
I don't do it intentionally, but I think I do it unintentionally, because I make things that I'm in the mood for, and different seasons put me in different moods. So, no, I don't plan out that I'm going to do it this way, but you know, when fall comes on, I start getting in the mood for a sizer. Unfortunately, you know, by the time they're ready, it's midsummer. But I think I do it not so much so that it'll be ready at a certain time, but I do it at the moment, at the spur of the moment, because that's what I'm in the mood to make.
Yeah. Well, I personally, I really haven't given it any thought, except that I want to get there. I want to be able to brew things that are lighter in alcohol, lighter in flavor, you know, or I should say lower in alcohol, something that, you know, good for the summertime, something you can throw together in the winter that's going to, you know, finish out early summer, and, you know, be low enough in alcohol. You can, you know, you can down a couple, two, three bottles of it on a hot summer day, take it to the beach or the camping or whatever. And then in the wintertime, you know, getting into more of the darker stuff, the stout style braggots that I've, you know, the bourbon barrels and things that I've been working on. So I think, I mean, it's a plan for me. I want to plan my brewing a little bit. Not that we have any semblance of, I mean, it's either summer or it's winter out here in Southern California. So, but I want to at least get there. and at least plan for it, because it just makes better brewing sense to me if I could plan things along with the two seasons that we have here in Southern California. To get to before we, and I know we're running on late here, but I wanted to talk to Jeff for a minute. You know, briefly, Jeff, real quickly, setting up your own small tasting, and Ryan, you might chime in on this after Jeff, but putting a short list of judging requirements, that kind of thing. What do you, and I know you've done this in the past with friends. Ryan's done the same thing. Do you prepare any kind of a questionnaire, a list, or something that you hand them and say, hey, you know, when you taste this mead, these are the things that I want you to write down or whatever?
So when I did this in the past, I think, if I recall right, I did the variant of the BJCP judging form that they use at the Mazer Cup, which involves a lot more of the checklisting and a lot less of the just open comment section, if you will. I think to some extent that was a good thing, and I think to some extent that was a bad thing. The take-home message that I want to say, if you're going to set up a tasting among family and friends, is to know your audience. I had some people in my group of volunteers that were very experienced with wine tasting. They'd been to a lot of wine tasting events. They kind of knew this whole process of, you know, first you swirl it, then you smell it, then you taste it, then you take a long taste. This kind of thing. And they were able to tell other people there what this term legs meant. That's kind of amorphous if you're not into that kind of a thing. There are other people that really, they were just there to taste some mead because, oh my God, somebody they know makes mead. That's awesome. Know your audience. And I wouldn't set the bar too high for them. I wouldn't set the bar too low for them. The questionnaire that we had with Aaron, I think, is probably a little bit easier or more approachable than that, just because I think if you throw at, from hindsight being 2020, if you throw that whole big long questionnaire with all these different check boxes and all these things that they may be seeing or tasting or perceiving or what have you, they're going to start hunting for it, and they're going to spend a lot of time, you know, thinking, oh, do I taste a grassy aroma here? Do I taste this kind of aroma? And it just gets in the way. So as far as setting up a tasting, from what I've seen, here are my suggestions. For one, make sure you have plenty of water and something like a neutral food, like, you know, saltine crackers, oyster crackers, bread and butter, something you can use as a palate cleanser, available between courses or between meads, because especially if you've got meats with strong flavors, they kind of need to get the last flavor out of their mouth, get the new flavor in. You know, the tips that we shared last week, like, you know, from the tasting course that JD and I did, the couple of takeaways that I thought would be really good, especially for people that are a little bit more naive to this whole process. And I mean naive in an inexperienced way and not in a pejorative way, like you're dumb to this or something like that. Like I'm trying to talk down to people, but just inexperienced. For people that aren't as keen or as have done it as many times, things like, instead of just taking sniff, take a long inhale and see what you get that way, or the short sip and the long sip, because you will completely get different things. You can also talk about covering the lip of your glass, giving it a little swirl, and then taking a sniff of that, because that will volatilize some aromas that aren't present if you're just sitting and getting a whiff of an open glass. The other thing I would suggest is know how many meads you're serving your audience and plan your serving sizes accordingly. Because I had 5 meads in that taste test, and I was initially pouring about 2 ounces of each. So some of my judges were absolutely schnockered by the time we got to number 5.
Yeah.
Some were doing fine, and some were like, okay, so you need to give my wife half an ounce here because she's had enough.
Cool, good stuff. Ryan, briefly, any ideas on setting up a small tasting? I know you've done similar things in the past, right?
Yeah, so echo what Jeff said, know your audience. Really appreciate the work that Aaron did in putting together his kind of tasting sheets. Actually, I think that's something that we should maybe put on the website as well for people to see, because that's extremely helpful. And then the last thing is know what you want to find out from these, from your audience, from your tasters. I took Aaron's form, and I kind of got rid of, I took things that were going to be useful that I wanted to know and the things that weren't so important. You know, for example, I don't need my tasters to comment on the appearance. You know, I know what it appears like. I don't need them to comment on the carbonation or the color. I mean, they're not professionals. I'd rather find out what they smell, what they taste, and if they like it. That's kind of what I'm interested in, those three things. What do you smell, what do you taste, and what's your overall impression? So those are the three things I break it down to. And then depending on your audience, and this is what I also really liked about Aaron's worksheet, is that give people a glossary of terms to look at. A lot of people will struggle with kind of trying to come up with something out of the blue, but if something is suggested, they're able to pick it out. So for example, just say it's a melomel, and they, if you ask someone blind, what do you taste? They might not know, but if you say, okay, is it strawberry? Is it peaches? Is it raspberry? Oh yeah, it's raspberry. I'm getting raspberry. I really get that. Maybe a little bit of this or a little bit of that. And so giving people, especially people who aren't totally in tune with what they're tasting, kind of a glossary of terms that they can look at, or a glossary of flavors that they might be able to pick from, has been very helpful for me. Cause I've had a handful of tasters who just weren't seasoned enough to grab something out of thin air. But yeah, know your audience, know what you want to get out of it, and create something that's pretty simple and enjoyable.
Cool.
So just to comment a little bit on that, what I liked about Aaron's worksheet, as opposed to the BJCP, sheet that I'd handed out, the glossary was more focused. I think Aaron's worksheet had maybe 30 to 45 terms that they might see versus that the BJCP the checklist sheet that I had handed out during my tasting probably had about 30 terms for each category, for appearance, for flavor and aroma and things like that. I think that's just a little bit too much for the average bear. I like that Aaron's worksheet had a kind of a focused approach to it, and really, it might be a good idea, like Ryan said, once you know what you're looking for, tailor that glossary to what you're looking for, good and bad, rather than giving them a whole wide glossary approach to it. What could they be tasting that is desirable? What could they be tasting potentially a flaw? And work with that.
Cool. Sounds good, guys.
On the subject of judging, I understand that Aaron somehow managed to get hold of a taste of the original Heart of Darkness.
Oh, wow.
Now,
I forgot all about that.
Yeah. Now, let's see here. I want to ask Aaron a question. If you were to judge that mead on a scale 1 to 50, would you give it more than a 45?
Say 1 to 50. I see where this is going.
Would you give it more than a 45? Say no.
Say no. I'm like looking through my emails to see how the murmur works.
Oh. Tell him you'd give it a 46.
There you go. A 45.1.
Oh, my God. Yeah, Chris must have listened to the last show. I don't know how the hell he found out, but yeah, dude, you missed it, man.
I didn't get to hear it, but I just wanted to know if he spoke about it. I'll have to go back and listen.
Dude, he took a 6-hour side trip just to go to Shrams.
Call me crazy.
I just want to know. On the 1 to 50 scale, I want to know where you scored that one.
You know, it was up there. It was definitely up there. I
44,
didn't put
43.
40.
Guys, now he's leading you off.
I know. I'm going to stick with my 45.1. 45.1.
Well, tell him you don't have anything to compare it to until you get his heart murmur.
There you go. There you go.
I like you 0.1% less.
Oh, wow.
Too funny.
That is too funny. I'll tell you what, Chris paying attention tonight after being AWOL for a couple of weeks. But hey, we're glad you're back in the saddle again. I tell you what, we had a lot of fun here tonight. I want to thank Christian for passing around that question about the Lalazine. Hopefully it's good enough for you. If not, hey, feel free to email us back, and we'll go into more detail if we can. Good discussion on the hop thing. I tell you what, guys, why don't we come back next week minus Ryan, and let's do this all over again. So, got a plan? That's a plan.
Sounds like a plan. Yeah.
I'll settle right now. That's a plan.
And safe travels to Ryan.
Safe travels to Ryan. All right, guys.
Thank you.